I'm Christopher Ludden. This is Open Source. Jaw-jaw is always better than war-war, as Winston Churchill put it. So the world sighs relief at Iran's agreement to stop thinking about nuclear arms for a good long while. And we look for fresh bearings on the ancient Persian nation, which has one of the youngest populations in the world, a country at sword points with the United States for most of 60-odd years. And just as important, there are people who've been invisible to us through official slanging contests and a dense fog of propaganda, theirs and ours. Here's a quick first sample of Iranian voices in the U.S. this week.
As someone whose family was more or less forced to leave Iran under difficult circumstances, many of us raised our hopes in 2009 with the Green Movement, and I think that this really is giving us a glimmer of a possible way by which the internal dynamics in Iran also could be altered, changed, and improved.
People are not revolutionaries in Iran today. They are reformists. They feel like the previous generation in 1979 went through a revolution to remove one form of repression only to find a much worse form of it come to the scene. The issue is that people are really tired of confrontation with the West. They actually don't believe in it. There are no ill feelings toward the U.S. And they just want normal foreign policy that will not overshadow and constantly make it impossible to work on the domestic scene.
I think to myself that President Obama deserves his Peace Nobel Prize right now. But also we have to give credit to President Rouhani for really pushing on the diplomatic route and trying to deal with diplomatically with the hardliners in Iran. It is very, very important to realize for the security of the world to take the diplomatic route and to make peace rather than war. It's a lot easier to make war than peace.
Steve Kinzer takes our first crack this hour at some of the new realities. He was the New York Times man covering Tehran in the 90s. 5 years ago, he wrote a book called Reset, with an unorthodox vision of an American position in the Middle East that would be closer to Iran and Turkey, not so close to Saudi Arabia and Israel. Is that what's underway? Our guest in the studio in Boston, Gulnush Niknejad, publishes Iranian news and views every day through The Guardian to the world. For the geostrategic long term, we'll be drawing on the big picture man East and West, Chaz Freeman, from the Nixon to China breakthrough 40 years ago. Steve Kinzer, get us started. You wrote Reset. Is this what you had in mind?
We're now at the brink of a new relationship with Iran, and I think that's positive for Iran, but especially positive for the United States. When I wrote that book, I was looking at America's interests, and that's really the way I look at the world. I'm trying to think like people in every country should, about what's good for us. So what's good for the United States is to find partners in other parts of the world who fit two qualifications. First of all, your partner should be a country whose society looks somewhat like yours, and Iranian society does look a lot like ours. And secondly, your partner should be a country whose long-term interests parallel your own long-term interests. In fact, what's good for Iran over the long run is good for us. But what's good for Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, even Israel over the long run is not good for us. What they want is bad for us. And what we want is not what they want. Iran over the long run has a great potential as a partner for the United States in that part of the world. And I think what's really struck me about the debate in this last week or so since the agreement was signed is this. Even people in Washington and in the chattering class who favor the agreement tend to say it's the best way to corral Iran. This is the way we can cut down their influence. We want to make sure that we can be dominant in our relationship with them. And this is the way to watch them, monitor them, control them. You never get out of the paradigm of conflict. It's just an idea that this agreement is a way to manage our conflict with Iran more effectively and be victorious more quickly and more fully. You never get this idea that maybe we can break out of this and it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game and that what's good for Iran isn't necessarily bad for us. In fact, it might be good for us. So I think that's the long-term goal for us, is to realize that this is not just a way for us to manage a hostile relationship, but it could be a way for us to change the relationship in a way that not only would be good for us and Iran, but for the entire Middle East.
I so agree with you about the lines we're hearing, all the party lines. It is being more, how could we be more punitive? How could we have got a better deal, made them grumble a little more or something? We'll come back to that. But go back, Steve, to an earlier book you wrote, which I still consider absolutely remarkable, called All the Shah's Men. With a lot of scholarly help from Iran, you wrote about the CIA's disruption of the Mossadegh post-colonial Iranian democracy back in 1953, an event that casts a huge shadow, not just in Iran, but our policy in the Middle East, but almost everywhere. In what sense have we left that model of kind of ruthless intervention?
Slowly now, I think we're coming to realize that these violent interventions in the political lives of other countries actually come back to hurt us in the end. This Iran operation in 1953, in which the CIA destroyed forever, at least up to now, Iranian democracy, seemed like a success at the time. We got rid of a guy we didn't like, Mohammad Mossadegh, and we replaced him with a guy, the Shah, who would do everything we wanted. So it seemed like the perfect solution at the time. Now, when we look back and we see that the Shah's increasing repression caused huge problems inside Iran, it led to the explosion that produced the mullah's government, and it led to another 35 years of repression, we're slowly coming to realize that these interventions hurt us over the long run. And I really am impressed with the way Obama has begun to defend this agreement.
Yes.
I think his biggest failures in foreign policy have been times when he's been seduced into intervening, whether it's South Sudan or Libya. And his greatest successes have been places where he's restrained himself. Now, sometimes I think the interventionist impulse of the United States is like a pendulum, that it swings. And maybe we're in a little bit non-interventionist mode now because we just lost two wars and we got a few big punches in the face. What I'm worried about is what happens after Obama? Are we still on a more non-interventionist path, or is the pendulum going to swing back? I think we're still at a point in American history where we're just learning about the long-term impact of our interventions. So I'm still not sure how to answer that question.
How would President Obama explain why now, why this is happening in 2015?
Frankly, I think it's something he couldn't do in his first term. And I also think a lot of it has to do, frankly, with our neighbor, John Kerry. I happen to know, I'm not sure this was the reason why we're having a new agreement with Iran, that John Kerry is a big fan of that book you mentioned, All the Shah's Men. He's brought it into his office and asked me to sign it. He's recommended it to many people. I don't want to say that it all started there, but I think Kerry definitely has an understanding that the U.S.-Iran relationship did not begin and end in 1979 and 80 with the hostage crisis, which is what I think most Americans and certainly most people in Washington believe. As far as they're concerned, the hostage crisis starts and ends everything. But for the Iranians, that crisis was just a little blip, and the real big event was what happened in 1953. When I first went to Iran years ago, I remember asking people, "This country is so old and so cultured and so sophisticated. Why didn't you ever get to build a democracy here?" And I had people say to me, "Oh, well, we had a democracy here until you showed up and took it away from us."
This is a further injury, of course.
Once you understand that, you understand where we are now.
And we barely need to mention the Iran-Iraq war, in which we sponsored a guy named Saddam Hussein in an attack that cost millions of Iranian lives. Move on, though. I want to kick the tires of the lines we're being fed. Can you call this a treaty when Ash Carter, our Secretary of Defense, and Tom Friedman in the New York Times, for example, say openly that we are reserving the right to destroy, without warning or negotiation, any Iranian attempt to build a bomb? That doesn't sound like an agreement exactly.
It's certainly not a treaty, and I think Obama has made clear he doesn't want this to be a treaty because that requires a two-thirds approval of the U.S. Senate. He just calls it a joint plan of action, or it's got some kind of a euphemism for it, so it doesn't require a full treaty status. I do think, however, that it's important for people that really want to follow this to ignore a lot of the white noise that's been going on. Ever since this negotiation began, many months ago, you've been hearing the back and forths, and somebody in Washington would say something, and then in Iran there'd be a statement, we're never going to allow inspections. Suddenly there's lots of upheaval. All of that should be ignored. That's just posturing. And I think maybe Ash Carter's feeling in an angry mood, but more likely he's saying what he thinks he needs to say in Washington. He's throwing some red meat to people in the Senate who want to hear that kind of thing. Details of how we threaten each other should not divert us from the central purpose here. So I don't want to get distracted and get angry when somebody on one side threatens the other. In a way, they may feel like that's what they need to do in order to get this approved. So I don't take that seriously.
I want to wonder also, Steve, was this really a triumph of diplomacy rather than a result of crushing sanctions and overwhelming imbalances of power? I'm reminded of, you know, Thucydides made famous the Athenian logic crushing the Melians, the rule being that the strong do what they can, the weak suffer what they must. Isn't there something of that here?
Not only is there something of that here, that is the basic principle by which the world functions. Everybody should understand that. That is the rule of life in the world. Now, why did Iran come to the table? Now, sanctions was part of it, but I think sanctions produces somewhat of a popular pressure, but it doesn't really pressure the regime directly because the sanctions really only hurt ordinary people. They don't hurt people that are in regime circles and well-to-do circles. Something else happened, and that is we changed our offer. So under the Bush administration, we had an offer to Iran. That is, we'll negotiate, but there can be no nuclear energy, no enrichment of any kind in Iran. We changed the deal and we decided we'll negotiate how much enrichment you can have. Once we opened that door, everything turned out to be possible.
Hold it there, Steve. When we come back, I want to be sure we touch on this question of, was it really about nuclear weapons? Iran, I always thought, had little reason to want them, much less to use them. Henry Kissinger would have been happy to have the Shah get nuclear weapons, and MIT would have built his program, you know, for Iran. When we come back, our Tehran Bureau here in the WBUR studio, Golnush Niknejad. We're talking about Iran after the nuclear deal. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. With a no-nukes agreement finally in hand from Iran, we're looking anew through the Persian curtain, and there really is such a thing. Our guest, Golnush Niknejad, pierces it every day, journalistically. She is the Iranian-born editor of the Tehran Bureau, which is an online journal of mostly anonymous reporting on the little things of Iranian life and politics, and the big trends, too. Strangest of all, she is based in Boston and known everywhere as Kelly. Welcome, Kelly. Steve Kinzer is still with us, and you're free to jump in, Steve, and you're free to disagree with Steve on anything, Kelly.
Thank you.
We see Tehran on our television images dancing and singing about this deal. Take us through the performance level here. What's going on?
Iranians will take any opportunity they have to come in the public space and express themselves the way they would like to express themselves. They can't do that. There are moments in time, like right before, you know, there's a poll during elections, during campaigning, where they can do that, where they can get away with that because the Iranian government does like to have people all over the world see how involved people are in the elections and how there's probably a higher turnout there than there is in America or a lot of other democracies. So opportunities like this are taken advantage of. And
How are you yourself feeling about it? Steve speaks for the United States. What's the Iranian interest here?
Every Iranian that I've spoken to has been very happy about it, whether they have been pro or anti-regime. They've been happy about this reconciliation of sorts. Someone said it's very bittersweet on an emotional level. He said we all believe that, the bad guys got away with it. But on the other side, we know that it's going to mean, you know, a lifting of sanctions. It's going to be a huge psychological pressure that's taken off the people. It's going to mean hopefully business flowing in. It's going to be normalizing relationships. It's going to mean a lot of the things that being having friendly relationships with America is going to mean for Iran.
Kelly, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So I was just in Iran a few weeks ago, spoke to many, many people about this. Everybody was positive. But I was struck by one factor. So after I would ask them, what do you think about the agreement? Do they love it? What do you think about America? We love America. But then I said to them, now after this agreement is signed and there are changes in sanctions and the nuclear issue seems off the table, don't you think there's going to be a political evolution inside the country? It will also mean that we're going to move away from this form of government to another form. And they all said, no, it doesn't. It will not affect the internal politics of Iran. We love the agreement. It's great in many ways. But it's not going to change our government. Do you agree?
I think that if we believe that change doesn't have to happen overnight, then I disagree with them, that it's going to be a gradual thing. Everything we see, even Rouhani's presidency, the negotiations, have a lot to do. They have, you know, they come from what happened in 2009. 2009 came about from what happened in 1999 when there were student demonstrations. So it's happening very gradually. Even though the government, you know, ratchets up whatever it's doing, whether it clamps down, it has to recalibrate in order to be able to survive. And their interest is, you know, regime survival. So.
We haven't mentioned the cash bonus in this deal. I mean, there's $100 billion that will be going to Iran very soon as the sanctions are lifted. There's business interest everywhere. There's this flood of goodwill. That's going to bend the politics of Iran. But what are they going to do with this moment? Who's going to take the lead in saying, here's where we'll spend it. Here's what we'll invest in.
I wish I knew the answer to that question. I mean, it depends on who you listen to. Some Iranian economists have said that it's not that much. It's probably more like $59 billion, and the economy's in bad shape. Rouhani has to attend to these issues. And, of course, there's others who believe that this is going to be a boost for the Revolutionary Guards and, you know, their proxies in the region like Hezbollah. And a lot of it is probably according to, Dr. Ziba Kalam, who is we interviewed recently. He said that a lot of it is just going to probably go to corruption. It's going to disappear. And
Steve, what's your guess? Who gets the money?
I'm so impressed that the agreement was signed on Tuesday, and already on Sunday, which is only 5 days later, the German Minister of Economy was in Tehran with a huge delegation of German businessmen.
The French won't be far behind either.
And I hope the Americans will get into that deal. I mean, I was there and I saw how much people were talking about how many thousands of trucks they need to buy. They need something like 500 airplanes. There's no country in the world that needs to buy hundreds of passenger airplanes because this is the last big untapped consumer market in the world. There's nothing else like this out there. And not only do they need so much stuff and are very tuned into what the West produces and wants it, but because of their oil and gas resources, they have money to pay for it. So I see this as a big factor pushing the agreement. I think the fact that there's so much money to be made brought forces inside the United States that might normally not be interested in these kinds of issues into the debate, and quietly, I think the profit motive did provide some extra incentive and momentum to allow this process to reach its full conclusion.
We've got to talk about the hardliners, but especially about the youth. The young generation is crucial to everything, but we get so many different views of them. They're supposed to be smart, also oblivious. They weren't there in 79. They're pro-American, said to be anti-government, but also that they're deep into drugs, out of their minds into sex in what used to be a puritanical culture. I mean, where's to begin? Kelly.
Where to begin? A lot of young people do not remember the revolution. Some that are getting older remember being children when there was a war and how scary that was and how there was a scarcity of many things. Those who came of age with the internet and satellite television and, and the administration of the reformist administration of Khatami in the 1990s, where there was a brief period of about 2 years where there was a lot of openings in terms of cultural freedoms and newspapers printing, and a lot of journalists, a lot of people became very political and idealistic during that period. And we also have another generation coming about that didn't really, wasn't part of that, but they came about during Ahmadinejad when, and they have a very different political awareness. And I think most of their ideas of freedom are probably what they see on satellite television.
Speaking of the rising generation, Narges Barjogli is an Iranian-American anthropologist at New York University. She published a piece this week in your Tehran bureau on the latest propaganda tactic from the regime in Iran. It was a patriotic rap video shot on a battleship by a prominent rapper meant to appeal to young voters and to assert that we're here to defend the Gulf. I asked Narges Barjogli to define the spirit of this generation, which will decide the shape of Iran to come.
It's a young population that has very high levels of education, including men and women. About 60-some percent of university students in Iran today are females. So this is a population that is very educated, very connected to what's going on in the rest of the world. Restless in the sense that there is an opportunity in the country. It's not a population that necessarily wants to completely overthrow everything. It's a young population, but with some sort of political maturity. That's why you see a big push for reform in the country rather than revolution.
Three things to reform over the next year. What would they be?
Ideally, three things to reform. One would be laws and restrictions against civil society. During the Ahmadinejad years, basically civil society was shut down. President Rouhani hasn't taken many steps to reform that yet. The second would be reforming the universities. Again, during the second term of Ahmadinejad, the universities became huge centers for surveillance. Many student leaders were put in prisons, and many of the best universities in Tehran closed their doors at 5 o'clock for students not to congregate and things like that. So there's a big push for the universities to be reformed again. And I think the third thing, and this is very much a hope, and I'm not sure if it'll happen, but is to reform laws and restrictions against women, and especially women's dress in Iran.
What is the power in the country, religious, revolutionary, doing to reintroduce itself to this generation?
I think the Islamic Republic knows that it has a riddle on its hands. How does it communicate the ideas of its revolution and the first decade of the Iran-Iraq war to a population which doesn't remember either? So you have 75% of the population under the age of about 35, and a population that rose up in the millions in 2009 and was very sort of disillusioned with the government. So the Islamic Republic is trying very hard at the moment and has poured a lot of money into media production because they realize Iran's population, young population, is very much connected to the internet and also is constantly watching satellite television. So in order to counter that, they're trying to create what I would call really like smart and sophisticated propaganda films and television serials that look very different from what they produced in the 1980s and 90s. And they're trying to produce it in such a way in which the audience can't tell that that there's government money behind these films and television serials. And yet at the same time, within them, they're trying to include messages of, you know, that the Islamic Republic can be positive. And I think they're playing definitely into this fear that all the countries around Iran are in one way or another in some sort of chaos. And so the Islamic Republic plays on this and says, we may not be great, you may not love us, but we're better than any alternative that exists in the region today. And if you try to rise up against us again, we may turn into Assyria. That's the regime line. And that's what they're promoting in their media.
That was Narges Barjogli at NYU. I said to her, the sort of better us than chaos line didn't work for Assad in Syria. Is it going to work in Iran?
Well, it has.
Well, let me try that one. So, because she made a point that Golnish also made, and to me, this is maybe the biggest thing I've learned from all my trips to Iran and all my immersion and talking to so many Iranians. I've learned a lot about life in the world and the Middle East from my Iranian friends, but maybe the biggest cosmic lesson I've learned from them has to do with timing and schedules. You know, after the 2009 Green Movement was crushed, I was in Iran shortly thereafter, and I met a guy, and he said, you know, we didn't get what we wanted. We're still going to get it. It just won't come on the timetable that we wanted. And they'll say, I've heard Iranians say to me when I tell them what a terrible time Iran had in the 18th and 19th and early 20th centuries, they say, oh, we just had a couple of bad centuries. That's nothing. We've been around 25 centuries. And I think this is the great message that Iran has for the countries in the region. Don't do this. Don't overthrow regimes before you're sure you know what's coming next. We have such a painful experience with this. Don't do it. So this is, to me, a level of sophistication that other countries in the region don't have. And I think this is something so important as a message that Iranians can give to the countries in the neighborhood.
Gulnish.
I think the Iranians have more going for them than the Syrians. And so when there was violence, they retreated and they went back home. And when the Arab Spring started, and in the beginning, when they started shooting everyone, they continued to come out. I think in the beginning there was something they called the Arab envy because they weren't willing to stand up. But after a while, when they saw the way the Arab Spring was going in the direction of the 1979 revolution, then the narrative changed to we don't want revolution precisely for that reason because it looks a lot like 1979. And that's the popular saying right now that, yeah, we don't want that because revolutions don't turn into good things, and we have more and more examples of them.
I wonder, does the power in the country, the orthodox revolutionary generation, know yet, much less admit that they're embattled?
Definitely. I remember the ideologues. I know what religious hardline Iranians, revolutionaries look like, act like, feel like, talk like. And when I was living in the UAE and coming face to face and meeting with them again, it was just a shell of that. I think there are still religious people in Iran, but this government doesn't represent that religion that they thought they had a revolution for, the religion that they practice. And a lot of people who do support the government, the regime, it's because they're employed and they have power. They've had a taste of power. It's very nice. And they want to maintain it. And they have the guns. So,
can I ask you, how long do you give them in power?
Me? Well, I've been taught by my Iranian friends not to put schedules on things. And actually, if I tell you they're going to be gone tomorrow, maybe the Iranians wouldn't like that because you don't know what's coming next. You want to wait and see first. I think this is the great message of Iranians. Let's try to reform what we have. A situation here is not so bad that we want to throw ourselves on the bayonets of the Revolutionary Guard. So I think we're going to get the result we want, I'll repeat, but it's just not going to come on the schedule that we set.
But are you ducking the question or imparting an ancient wisdom?
No, I don't think it's going to end. I don't think there's going to be a day when the mullahs fall. I think you may see evolution. For example, the supreme leader may die sometime. If the supreme leader dies, will there be another supreme leader? Maybe not. Maybe there won't be another supreme leader. Maybe there'll be a different kind of a form of government. You'll see evolution there towards a more open society. But I have to add that the openness of Iranian society now is already considerably greater than the openness in places like Saudi Arabia and much of the rest of the region. So they don't have as far to go as some of us might think.
I'm just thinking how the supreme truculence of Ahmadinejad seems ancient history now. We've gone a long way from that. Where are we heading?
It's a long way back now. I can tell you this, though. When I was just in Iran, as I said a few weeks ago, I noticed for the first time, maybe I just wasn't seeing it clearly enough, a real latent but palpable disgust with religious rule. I give you just a couple of examples. I was sitting in a cafe in Isfahan, And I was sitting with the two girls that ran the cafe. They were just chatting with each other next to me. And a mullah walked by with his religious garb on. And as soon as he turned his head, one of the girls made a gesture with her finger like you're shooting a gun at him. And they both broke out laughing. And then I was in Tehran, and I swear I sat for 10 minutes watching a mullah try to get a taxi. And at least 10 taxis passed him by. Nobody would stop for him. So I'm sensing that even the mullahs must be getting this message.
That's fantastic.
That's been happening for a long time. I remember, this is like almost 10 years ago, I met one of these MIT students who had come from Iran. And, you know, he was very clean shaven. He goes, you know what, in Tehran, this was probably like 15, 20 years ago. He goes, I had a mustache, I had a beard, I looked, you know, like a proper Hezbollah. And he goes, when I wanted directions, they would tell me, they would give me the wrong directions. So it's, you know, it's probably more and more, and that's why we're seeing it in such a conservative city like Isfahan. But it's been going on for a while.
It's important to us, and we've got to figure this out, that the man known as Hodor, Hossein Darakhshan, a proto-blogger, a world celebrity 10 years ago, living then in Toronto, an opponent of the regime, has been let out of prison finally. We're thrilled for the whole spirit of the thing, but we still don't yet know, A, whether he feels free to speak, or just what his new role will be. But we want to find out. We're talking about Iran after the nuclear agreement. Coming up, the long view and the chessboard judgment of the shockingly candid former ambassador Chaz Freeman. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Chaz Freeman was a young Foreign Service officer back in 1973 who got pressed into service as the translator in Beijing of the first direct conversations between Richard Nixon and Mao Zedong. Chaz Freeman worked a lifetime in the upper reaches of the U.S. diplomatic and security services with an extraordinary record of judgment, faulted only for speaking it too boldly. He told us this week that this agreement with Iran may have solved a problem we didn't really have.
Well, the nuclear agreement is a significant achievement in a sense. I think in practical terms it means less than many seem to imagine. Basically, the CIA, Mossad, other intelligence agencies have said that Iran does not have an active nuclear weapons program and has not had one since 2003, if it indeed had one then. But every politician in Israel and the United States has been convinced otherwise. And so,
really convinced or politically convinced?
Well, I think they've convinced themselves. Sometimes one inhales one's own propaganda and it gets quite intoxicated by it. I think that's happened in this case. What we've done, basically, I guess, is eliminate a program that probably didn't exist and ensure that we can verify that it will not exist for another 10 or 15 years. So that's good news. It means that proliferation in the region is, if not halted, at least slowed for that period. Israel will still have its nuclear weapons and retain a nuclear monopoly for a while in the Middle East. I think the Saudis and others, however, don't have much confidence that this agreement will ultimately prevent Iran from making a decision to build a nuclear weapon, and they will probably use the 10 to 15 year period to try to catch up with Iran so that they too have that capability if they must use it.
Our regime change era began with the Shah. Would you say that time is over?
Well, I hope that we have learned something about the perils of regime change, not only in the long term, as in the case of Iran, but in the short term. I mean, after all, we have attempted regime change, most recently in Iraq and Syria now, and it hasn't worked out very well. In Iraq, we removed a regime without being able to install a new one that had any claim to legitimacy. And the Iraqi government now, of course, controls only a portion of Iraq's territory. Part is controlled by the Islamic State, so-called, and part by the Kurds, in part, frankly, by Shia militia, who are more powerful locally than the Iraqi state. Syria, for its part, has been partitioned between multiple contending forces and shifting lines of control and huge suffering, 250,000 dead and something like 10 million displaced out of a population of 24 million. So whatever our good intentions it may have been, if one gives us the benefit of the doubt, the results are decidedly messy and counterproductive. I think it's impressive that we did this nuclear agreement with European and Asian partners. The Russians, the Chinese, the Germans, the French, the British were all partners in this negotiation. The EU took a prominent role. And that is probably the wave of the future. If we want to get things done, we're going to have to do them in partnership with others. And this is a good precedent.
President Obama seems to be signaling a sort of change in our imperial temperament. How deep does that go? How long does it last, do you think?
Well, we are very divided as a country between elements that must be called xenophobic and chauvinist. One hears the sort of statements that some of the 16 people running for the Republican candidacy in the next election make about bombing and strafing and overthrowing and so forth, on the one hand. On the other hand, we have among that group Rand Paul speaking out in favor of a non-interventionist policy. He's sometimes accused of being isolationist, but I don't think that's the case at all. What he is cautious. And that seems to characterize the Obama administration, too, that there's some greater awareness of the limits of American power and some curtailment of overweening ambition of the sort we have seen in the recent past.
Isn't there a funny symmetry with what's going on between us and Cuba, these ancient, rather artificial enmities seeming to dissolve and still a problem with the crusty old adversaries in their governments, the Castro brothers and the mullahs?
One of the things we're going to see as a sort of experiment, there's a great deal of evidence that sanctions have the effect of not pulling down the regimes they target, but actually buttressing their power and authority. They give the leaders who are targeted the ability to blame almost everything on a foreign power, the United States in this case. And they also, to the extent that they ration imports to the country, give the government in charge, the leader in charge, the power of patronage on a level that he could only have dreamt about. It's really a politician's wet dream to be able to determine who gets what, when, and how, with the assistance of foreign enemies. So we've seen the Cuban regime last a very long time under heavy sanctions. The Iranian Islamic Republic, similarly, I think, has been buttressed by our opposition. Now, as the sanctions wind down and openness is introduced, it would be interesting to see whether the regimes don't have to begin to adapt in ways that they have not before. There may be positive change in the offing.
You were there, Charles Freeman, when Nixon did the impossible, Nixon to China and all that. What lessons to be drawn in this softening, opening to Iran, and what cautions?
Well, for one thing, the opening to China, strategically important and useful as it was, did not produce Sino-American cooperation on any level. For about 6 or 7 years, it took time to begin to make it possible for us to cooperate. Of course, in the Carter era, at the end of the 70s, we did normalize relations with China. And oddly, after a very tough start, they flourished under Ronald Reagan's government. So I wouldn't hold my breath for a major improvement in U.S.-Iranian relations. I think we have to be patient and we have to be creative. But the lesson of both events is that statesmanship, skillfully conducted, can really make a difference.
That was Chaz Freeman, one-time U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, many years in high government places in foreign affairs. Gulnush Niknejad is with us in the studio. She edits the Tehran Bureau. distributed by The Guardian from England. Steve Kinzer, also once the New York Times man in Iran, author of three remarkable books, I think, on this whole subject. All the King's Men, about the overthrow of the Shah. All the Shah's Men, I should have said. Another book called Reset, about what may be the shift underway in American policy overall. But also a book called Overthrow, Steve, about just what Chaz Freeman was talking about. You know, regime change as a major tool of American policy. Just reinforcing what he said about interventions that create chaos and disaster, and even sanctions that come back to haunt us, if not prop up, you know, the likes of the Castro brothers.
Ambassador Freeman used a great word, which is patient. That's a word that is almost never heard in American diplomacy. We don't like to wait and let situations develop on their own accord and at their own pace. We want everything to happen right now. We're a young country. Iran is about 10 times older than we are as a country. It has much more experience and is not eager necessarily to push history faster than history wants to unfold. That's a classically American desire to want to have everything now. So I think that this deal gives us the possibility to establish a framework in which we can manage our disagreements and finally begin to find places where we can cooperate. But let's not expect everything to happen soon. We've had an interesting breakthrough now. This is going to set the stage for other interesting breakthroughs in the future. But this is a long process. Let's not expect everything to happen overnight. But let's be sure we get the process begun.
Gulnish Niknejad, a.k.a. Kelly. Fill in some of the gaps about the youth of Iran. There's still a bit of a mystery, more than a bit of a mystery to me, often referred to as a terribly wounded, almost degenerate lost generation.
We are the lost generation. I think it was much more difficult for us coming of age in Iran after the revolution, the metamorphosis that took place. I mean, the 80s were very dark, and things have changed gradually and then very rapidly. And I have people who say, I haven't been to Iran for 2 months, but I've already lost track of all the changes that are taking place the past few weeks that I haven't been there. So, I mean, having to live such disjointed, almost schizophrenic lives, yep, where in public you have to be one person. When you're with government officials or you're thinking about your job or about wanting access to the country, you have to pretend to be one person and then being someone completely different behind closed doors. And, and even in the 80s, when you had to learn to lie, you had to learn to say you pray, you do these things, it creates, it spills over into other aspects of your lives. So I feel like those of us who left a long time ago have had a chance to get over it to some extent, to get better and get over it and deal with issues. And I think you see the damage that it's been done to those that are coming more recently and people who are there.
Yes, that's what I'm calling the Hoder generation, Hossein Darakhshan, proto-blogger, arrived like a bolt of lightning, and thousands of Iranian bloggers with him, early adapters, lots to say, quickly networked, a powerful group, and then smashed. What is the room for them in this new sort of honeymoon?
I don't know what's going on with Hoder, so I won't, anything I say doesn't necessarily refer to him. But what we see a lot of, during the Ahmadinejad, especially the second term, they put a lot of people in prison. And you see a lot of the people that were in prison actually having pretty prominent positions right now. So this government, this administration is dealing much more in a much more sophisticated way with people that were jailed by the hardliners, by the Revolutionary Guards. So it's hard to, I think they're, the way of dealing, Rouhani's people dealing with this young generation is making them part of the system, giving them a stake in it so that they do want to help perpetuate it.
Hmm. Steve Kinzer, you know Latin America too. I wonder, is it pure coincidence that both with Cuba and with Iran at the same time, we're being led out of these very hostile, prickly kind of eclipses of relations? What are the connections to be made there?
I don't think it's a coincidence. I think that Obama, with his basketball background, is thinking, I'm in the last quarter now. What do I want to get done before the final bell? And I think he had Cuba and Iran on his list. And as soon as the opportunity presented itself, he was not going to let this go by. He was going to make a change. I think the arrival of Kerry made a big difference. Kerry obviously has a much deeper interest in this than Hillary Clinton or anybody else that is around, has been around Obama. But I do think that Obama is realizing that, as you said at the beginning, the pieces on the global chessboard are not nailed onto the board. You can move them around a little bit. And the way we've been thinking for years is not the only way to think. There's not only one way to look at the world. And that's something that's very difficult for Americans to adjust to. I think we feel like we rule and we start all conversations in the world. Now we're starting to realize, as Ambassador Freeman said, that we can get more done by cooperating with others. And I think we've taken that role in Latin America for a while, and now we've made a big leap and brought it across the ocean.
Who do we have that's ready to sustain this spirit, Steve, on our political horizon? And let me just say, maybe mischievously, that John Kerry, I don't think he's ever given up the idea of being president. I mean, he didn't get those initials for nothing. I'm sure he's looking in the mirror and saying, looking mighty presidential these days, John. But who, besides Rand Paul, might continue a sort of cautious, realistic spirit?
Well, I'm not a Rand Paul fan. And in fact, as I understand, Rand Paul is now against the Iran agreement. So I don't consider him to be what he pretends to be, which is a non-interventionist. He's a non-interventionist when he feels like it.
So I like him better than you do. Let's just say that. But go
that's
ahead.
That's easy. Actually, I feel that our next president, when it comes to foreign affairs, will not be as good as this one. The next president will be more interventionist and will carry a bigger stick and will be less interested in cooperating with other countries than this president. Doesn't matter who it is. There's no one else out there running for president who is going to be as eager to cooperate with the rest of the world as Obama is. And let's face it, Obama wasn't like this either in the beginning. If he had been a little smarter and thinking like he is now, we wouldn't be in the mess we've created in Libya, for example. Where
you say we've got nobody. That means male or female, Republican or Democratic.
Absolutely. I don't see any candidate out there who about whom you could say this person is as non-interventionist as Obama. Every one of them is more instinctively oriented towards the traditional American big stick approach than Obama is.
You don't think Hillary Clinton is saying, wait a sec, something seems to be working here, and young people here and there seem to like it?
If Hillary Clinton were Secretary of State now, I don't think any of this would be happening. Maybe she's looking at it and saying, looks good, but it depends on what the focus group tells her.
Gulnush Niknajai, you get the last word on where we go from here, how we make the most of what intuitively feels like a better direction.
It's going to happen regardless of what the hardliners, both in the United States and Iran, want, because the power of the people is much stronger, and, you know, in Iran it certainly is.
Meantime, as Judge Friedman would say and did say to us, that China is setting a very different example and a productive alternative, it seems to me.
I hope ours comes with human rights.
And, of course, just to pick up on that, Iran now needs to make some steps to convince the rest of the world of its seriousness, as does the United States. And the step that I'm waiting for from Iran is they've got to free our friend Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post reporter who's been in jail in Iran for a year now for no reason. This would be the symbol to the outside world that many of us are waiting for. Let's get this poor guy out of jail, and we don't have to worry about these little problems that are going to upset people's feelings as we go forward in this big project.
And maybe a lot of their own journalists could get out with him. Thank you, Stephen Kinzer. Thank you, Gulnush Niknajad, a.k.a. Kelly. Thank you, Chaz Freeman and Nagas Bajogli. Listeners, please visit our website, radioopensource.org, for a reading list on Iran and an audio guide to the last 40 years of American-Iranian misunderstanding. and mistrust. While you're at it, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our show was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Pat Tomeno, with help from Grant Holub-Mormon and Zach Goldhammer. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.